Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's November 13, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Ernest Perry and Jim Flink, sitting in for Mike McKean. On our program this week, ABC reporter Amy Robach announces she has breast cancer, a diagnosis made after having her first ever mammogram on Good Morning America last month. CNN woos Brian Stelter from the New York Times to cover the media beat on its on-air, online, and other platforms, and to be host of the media criticism program Reliable Sources. And scientists discover a brand new body part. It's a great headline, clickbait to be sure, and it appeared all over. But how did the journalist miss the part about the discovery actually being made in 1879? There's a lot more that we'll hopefully get to as well, but we're going to start with developments in a couple of stories we talked about last week. This morning, Ryan Ferguson woke up a free man, released from prison hours after the state attorney general's office said it would not seek a retrial in the murder of Tribune sports editor Kent Heitholt.
Having gone through what I've gone through with our justice system, I was kind of scared about what was going to happen next. I didn't know this morning that I'd be standing here tonight. I didn't know anything. I didn't know the next step at all. And it's very scary, very daunting. So, you know, I'm very glad to be here, but I want to thank the Attorney General for looking at the facts of this case and making a decision based off those facts and doing the right thing.
All three of the network affiliates here in Columbia carried that news conference live last night, KMIZ going over to MyZoo, one of the other local stations, and the Missourian streamed it on its website. Just like we saw last week when Bill Ferguson and Attorney Kathleen Zellner spoke after the appellate court vacated the conviction. Last week, Ernest, you, Mike, and I talked about how we liked a lot of what we saw in the breaking news coverage when that ruling came down. What did you think yesterday?
Well, I think that the coverage was very hit and miss. It may have had something to do with logistics. It may have had something to do with when he got out. But it was one of those things where it kept bumping up into 6 o'clock and trying to get it connected to the newscast and not go over the newscast. And that didn't work out because the authorities didn't sort of follow the script that Bill Ferguson and the attorney wanted to do. I think that's what led to a lot of the coverage being sort of shaky in terms of television. The newspapers, they have a larger window. They could stream it at any time. So that gives them a lot more flexibility. But I think with the newscast, they were trying to time it just right, and it didn't quite work.
Yeah, and I think there was a lot going on behind the scenes. I talked to the leadership at KMIZ, KOMU, and Kansas City station KNBC today, and that's exactly what they said. Not only were times changing, but locations were changing. You know, they were moving to the jail instead of the courthouse. And so as a result, all of those stations had a lot of folks that were dedicated to coverage. But the problem is that, for instance, on a live shot, you know, they were having to use live view packs, these sort of mobile packs. And in some cases, that was saving their bacon because they were actually unable. They had run cable to one location and were thinking, this is where our live shot's going to be. And then the location changed. And that happened in more than one case yesterday. So on the one hand, it's a logistical nightmare for a television station or someone who's trying to live stream something, because when everything is changing, times, you know, and you can't plan these things, those become a challenge. And then on the other hand, you know, the new technological capabilities created opportunities where they might have had absolutely nothing at all in the background.
So you raised an interesting point when you talk about the UPAC. One of the things that I was kind of surprised about yesterday watching coverage online from basically the time in the middle of the afternoon that we found out that there was going to be another development in this case yesterday. Most of the reporting that we were getting was coming from Twitter. I kept going to local websites wondering, why aren't I seeing somebody who's just setting up a live camera and locking it down outside the prison in Jefferson City as soon as you get there, so that you see when the Fergusons pull up. You see when there's any kind of movement. You may see when, even though Ryan didn't walk out of the front door as had originally been in the script, we didn't see the prison van leave. Mm-hmm. To me, it felt like there were some missed opportunities during the course of the day.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with where you're going to be staged. And the news outlets were being told by the Fergusons and his people, here's where we're going to be at this time. Here's where we're going to be at this time. So this is where the news media was going. And then it didn't work out that way because they did have someone in Jeff City where he was ready to get that shot. But then all of a sudden they found out, well, wait a minute, he's already been sent to Boone County. So now you're scrambling, trying to either get to Boone County or get someone else over to Boone County to get that shot, but also got to be set up for the news conference. So it's just not having enough equipment and not being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, Elizabeth Frosch said they had 6 live capabilities yesterday, including the UPACs. And the reporter that they had dedicated in Jefferson City had to run over to Boone County and then had to move again. So I think that's exactly what's going on here is, you know, as a producer, as you mm-hmm. well know, you know, you've got this the other things that you're planning for in the day, and then everything goes crazy, and everything you planned is now on a second-to-second basis. And sometimes you can have all of that equipment and you can have all the people, but if they aren't deployed in the right spot, then you can't hit it at the right time.
So let's talk less about the coverage from what we saw yesterday. Let's talk about what happens next. There is always the possibility Ryan Fergusson could face charges in the future, but some legal experts have said the likelihood of that is pretty low. So as journalists, what is the second day? What's the third day? What's the fourth day story? What, if anything, should we be continuing to keep an eye on here?
Well, I think one of the things that you're definitely going to keep an eye on is what's going to happen with Erickson, the person who did, you know, in his own mind, mm-hmm. Some question in that, confess to this murder. And if all this evidence that seems to be pointing somewhere else and not at him and not at Fergusson, you know, what happens with him? Is he pretty much going to stay in prison? I mean, there's going to be an attorney, I would think. There's going to be an attorney who's going to look into whether or not there should be a case for him to get out. And also, then the next story would be, are you going to reopen this investigation to find out who did kill Ken Heidhoek? So that's another story in and of itself. And then the third story is, how did the prosecution screw this up so badly? What is it that they did? And it seems to point directly to evidence being withheld. And there are 3 cases right now in the state of Missouri involving withheld evidence in murder cases that are either in the appeals process or already at the Missouri Supreme Court. So this is an issue that really needs to be addressed in the state about prosecutors who are withholding evidence from defense attorneys and losing cases on appeal because of it.
I don't think there's any question. And you know, you look at the micro case itself and those 3 things. But that the idea of, and you mentioned this last week, the idea of prosecutors that run for political office mm-hmm. being in charge of prosecuting cases and oftentimes with greater ambitions, whatever they might be, you know, I think at some point that discussion has to go to another level and has to – if enough cases begin to surface that say that this – you know, in however small or large a way it is, becomes a pattern of it's more important to get a prosecution than it is to get the right person prosecuted and jailed. And then I think the other thing is how long it takes to get to the process of a wrongful conviction being reversed. I think that, you know, the fact that's taken as many years as it has, that has to be a part of the coverage
and
as well.
Kathleen Zellner even said last week that Ryan's case at almost 10 years still isn't the longest that she's worked on, that right now she's working on another case where there's somebody who's been in prison for more than 20. So that's another very
– I mean, even Ryan Fergusson brought it up in his comments last night at his press conference that, you know, he's learned, at least what he's saying is, I've learned that the justice system is not perfect and that you can talk about your innocence, you can scream that you're innocent until the cows come home. But if there's a prosecutor who is bent on making sure that you're prosecuted, that you spend some time in jail or in prison for a crime, they're going to make it happen. And it's up to you to actually figure out a way to prove your innocence. So the whole thing about innocent until proven guilty.
After conviction, it's guilty until you really have a preponderance of evidence in the other direction.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Well, let's turn for a minute and talk about 60 Minutes and the now retracted Benghazi report. CBS was clear it was going to stand by that story until Friday morning when Laura Logan issued this retraction.
You know, the most important thing to every person at 60 Minutes is the truth. And today the truth is that we made a mistake. And that's very disappointing for any journalist. It's very disappointing for me. Nobody likes to admit that they made a mistake. But if you do, you have to stand up and take responsibility, and you have to say that you were wrong. And in this case, we were wrong. We made a mistake. And how did this happen? Well, Dylan Davies worked for the State Department in Libya. He was the manager of the local guard force at the Benghazi Special Mission compound. And he described for us his actions that night, saying that he had entered the compound and he'd had a confrontation with one of the attackers. And he also said that he'd seen the body of Ambassador Chris Stevens in a local hospital. And after our report aired, questions were raised about whether his account was real after an incident report surfaced that told a different story about what he'd done that night. Denied that report. Mm-hmm. And he said that he told the FBI the same story that he had told us. But what we now know is that he told the FBI a different story to what he told us. And, you know, that was the moment for us when we realized that we no longer had confidence in our source and that we were wrong to put him on air. And we apologize to our viewers.
You can watch the rest of that segment on our links blog. There was another retraction, the official one on 60 Minutes, that was about 90 seconds long, and it was at the very end of the broadcast Sunday night. It was a pretty painful segment to watch Friday morning, but that 90-second retraction on 60 Minutes, was it enough?
I think they did about as good as they could. I mean, she went on the air on Friday on one of their key news broadcasts and issued an apology, and we just heard it and just saw it. And then on 60 Minutes at the end, when they have a larger audience, you know, she did an apology not only for herself but also for the program itself. So I think that in terms of apology, I think they've done enough. The question becomes, how did this happen?
And that's what we aren't really getting out a clear answer to, are we?
Well, and I think that's part of the problem. I mean, there were plenty of red flags on this report before it ever went to air. And certainly, I think Ernest is right. They have done the things they needed to do that news organizations do, say we're wrong, publicly do it on air, that kind of thing. But, you know, the fact that Laura Logan took a stage and was talking about Benghazi and how America must seek some sort of retribution a year before this calls into question her impartiality. I think, you know, there are questions about why did she believe this source? Did she do her due diligence? And I think this is a black eye on really one of the best news products that we all know, and that is 60 Minutes. And I think it calls into question because CBS executives were in the audience when she talked about exacting revenge for Benghazi, and she talked about it in terms of we, the United States. So, you know, I think in review, I think what a lot of critics are saying is, CBS, why didn't you know? Should Laura Logan have been the person who did this report? Why didn't you do your due diligence? Why did you stand by the report? So there are a myriad questions that I don't know that CBS and 60 Minutes have gone far enough to answer. And I think until they go to that point, a lot of people are going to continue to ask questions.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where you need to bring someone in from the outside to do a little bit of independent investigation as to how this story developed, and looking at number one, why was it that she or someone else did not check with the FBI to make sure that this report was the report that he gave? Because the first time I heard that, I was going like, wait a minute, this goes against the whole adage of, hey, if your mom says she loves you, check it out. You know, you've got to check those facts. I mean, to go on the air with a story from this guy without checking to see whether or not his report matches the one that the FBI had or even comes close to it, that's just a cardinal sin in journalism, I would think.
So back in 2004, Dan Rather found himself in a very similar situation and having to issue a retraction. Is it related to another story? And that was pretty much the death of his career. Is Laura Logan vulnerable in your eyes in the same way?
Well, I'm not sure. A lot of it's going to depend on what comes out after this. She's a very credible reporter. She does a lot of good reporting, especially in war zones and in conflict zones. So that gives her some cachet there. But then again, Dan Rather also had a lot of cachet. I mean, going all the way back to the 60s when he was a local reporter. And you see what happened with his. I think the difference between what's happening with Laura Logan and what's happening with Dan, what happened with Dan Rather is that you were talking about a president, and you were talking about it in the context of a campaign. This is an investigation that's still being conducted by the government, by Congress, and we still don't know all of what happened in Benghazi. So this becomes a part of that narrative. So I think that she does have a little bit of cushion there.
And the only other thing I would add is that the media climate is so much different now. There's so many more players. There are so many more products. And so chances are her career goes on. Maybe there's a blemish on it or a black mark on it. But for the most part, I think her career goes on in a way because there are just so many more voices, if nothing else.
Okay. Well, it's November, Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. And the No Shave November movement has found its place on morning TV. At the Today Show, Matt Lauer, Al Roker, and Willie Geist are growing beards to raise awareness. And last week, Lauer and Roker had cameras follow them for prostate exams live on the air. This type of screening has become something we've gotten used to on morning TV since Katie Couric's colonoscopy in 2001. And usually these televised medical tests come off as completely routine. Usually. Monday, ABC reporter Amy Robach told viewers her first ever mammogram, televised on Good Morning America, revealed a diagnosis of breast cancer.
Inside that van, I was pretty calm, and there really wasn't anything to be scared of. It was over in a few minutes, and then my smiling friends were waiting for me.
And it hurt so much less than I thought it was going to hurt. It was like nothing.
I got to tell you, she was so nervous this morning. She is so happy right now. I could just see the relief.
And that was it. Or so I thought, because a short time later, I was asked to come back for more scans. Then last week, a tornado of tests. Doctors move quickly when they're concerned. Finally, the diagnosis that's still hard for me to say out loud. I have breast cancer. I know that I have a fight ahead of me, but I also know that I have a lot worth fighting for. And I'm so grateful that I got that mammogram that day at GMA. Robin's words still echoing inside of me. If I got the mammogram on air and it saved one life, then it's all worth it, she had said. It never occurred to me that life would be mine.
So Robach is scheduled to undergo a double mastectomy tomorrow. The idea behind these televised screenings is to show the audience that these tests aren't all that hard to go through. But what happens when you end up with a result like this?
Well, I think what happens is that it really opens the eyes of the viewers, the people that they were trying to connect with to begin with, that these tests are important and they can be life-saving. And I think that it does the service, the public service, that oftentimes you don't see on these morning programs because they become so celebrity-driven and so gimmick-driven in a lot of the segments that they do. This is something where you go like, okay, morning television can provide a public service to people and really be helpful in terms of actions like this.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. In this moment, this is what is so right and what is so wrong about television right now is there's so much of the personalities, sort of it's the riding the tricycle, it's riding the elephant, it's watch me do this. And you know, obviously it works or they wouldn't do it. On the other hand, sometimes you think, what could you be devoting your time to if you weren't doing this segment? What other issues could you be discussing? And so on the one hand, you see that it worked, and it does send the message, hey, sometimes the test doesn't turn out, but she would have never gotten the test, so maybe she got it early. So that's the good thing. But then, I think the bad thing is spend some more time. The interesting thing, and I worked in Kansas City in television mm-hmm. for 15 years, and Larry Moore is a case and example. He took his cancer fight very publicly on the air and won a lot of praise and a big audience share for that and a lot of respect. So it's good for the journalist and it's good for the brand, but it does beg the question, if nothing is revealed, could we have spent our time better, and do we do too much of this at the cost of other journalistic enterprises?
So in choosing to have a test like this done on the air, Amy Robach decided to go ahead and share the results. In your opinion, if somebody has the test, is there the obligation to share the results and let somebody know what the outcome is?
Well, I think once you put it out there and you make it public and you become a public figure in that way, I think there is an obligation to tell the public whether the test was positive or negative. Because I think there would have been some backlash had she not gone public with what the results of that would have been, either positive or negative. And you do run the risk of it just being a gimmick if every one of these tests wind up being negative.
Or you see the test and then never hear anything about it again. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Agreed.
You totally agree. You do run the risk.
You follow through.
Okay. Well, so speaking of medical stories, there were some big headlines last week. Surgeons found a new ligament in the human knee. The anterolateral ligament, present in 97% of humans, could play a role in the recovery of people who end up with ACL tears. It's a pretty common injury among athletes. Stories showed up in USA Today, Vanity Fair, MSN, Fox News, Gizmodo, Time. The list goes on. Only there was a problem. The journalist reporting on this scientific research didn't read it carefully enough to notice that in the abstract of the study, it said the ligament was discovered 134 years ago. Oops. I mean, in all seriousness, how does this happen?
Well, it happens because you're skimming. This is the classic case of a reporter is handed some information, and instead of reading all the way through it, they're skimming, looking for bits and pieces of information that they can plug into a story that they can make into a larger story. And oftentimes, when you're reading these journal articles, they pretty much highlight whatever's new at the top, and if you don't go to the bottom, or in some cases all the way to the bottom, you don't run into that nugget that went, wait a minute, 1870?
Although, in this particular case, those are the first two words in the abstract.
It was in the first sentence.
It is. And you're absolutely right. Journalists don't like to read medical abstracts. They no. they absolutely can't think of it. They'd rather have, their eyes, gouged out or something. But to your point, this is about headline writing. This is about if you tried to write a story that said this was discovered 130 years ago and just now we're looking into multiple usage, people would be like, okay, well, that's not news, right. and would move on. This way they go, whoa, I've got a body part I didn't even know about. Right. Now they're in.
Well, I think the even larger story here, which I think they should have focused on more so than this being new, which it wasn't, is that in athletes – especially those who are suffering ACL tears, this may be the ligament that's causing them problems when they're trying to rehab, or they go back out onto the field or back out onto the court and something doesn't
and
quite work right.
There would be a huge audience for that, given the number of ACL tears that mm-hmm. we see in high school and college athletes.
Right, right. To me, that was a story. If they'd have led with that and focused in more on that, and the fact that doctors who specialize in this area are starting to look at this as a possible problem with ACL reconstruction, that would have been the story. That would have led ESPN right away.
I do think, though, that it is part of the problem that we have to navigate in this day of clickbait, mm-hmm. is this idea that the headline has to grab you even if it's marginally bordering on the truth. And, I think there isn't probably a newsroom in the country right now that isn't with multi-platform execution strategies trying to figure out, how do I navigate between the thing that I know will get the OMG and the thing that really people need to know, or the value that's therein. And it's it's something that I don't know that there is a newsroom that isn't fighting it.
Right, but when you do something like this, it really hurts your brand. I mean, it damages your credibility.
And I think that's how we found ourselves here with, what, half a dozen different examples of the same story. If it was really just a problem of skimming the research, maybe you'd see it in one place. Maybe you'd see it in two. You wouldn't see it in six or seven or eight publications. That the dominoes fall once one sees that there's that great headline that they may be able to capitalize on.
And it's the problem in a curated environment. Mm-hmm. And we're so many folks established and establishing are using curated content. And to your point, aren't necessarily researching the story. It's just a republish.
Or it's
just something that is
cursory. Or you just
grab
it and put it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's basically what they're doing.
Well, our listeners and viewers who visit our links blog on KBIA.org know that we often get background on a lot of our topics based on stories reported by the New York Times' Brian Stelter. Well, yesterday, CNN announced it's hired Stelter away from the Times to cover media on all of its platforms and host reliable sources. When Stelter was here on campus last week, he spoke to our students and faculty about the importance of media criticism and how there's a need to explain how journalists do our work. How do you see him carrying that out on Reliable Sources?
Well, I think on Reliable Sources, you're going to see him every Sunday. He's going to talk about it. He's going to be across their platforms. He's going to be quoted in the New York Times, his former employer, and in other places about media criticism. So I think it gives him a larger platform by which to talk about a lot of the issues that we talk about on this program and reach a wider audience. So I think that's to me, that would be the benefits of him going to CNN. The issue for the New York Times is they seem to be losing their stars over and over.
A lot of top talent in
the last 2 years. And I think a lot of that can be attributed to the fact that the people that they're losing are going to places where their brand can be spread across these multiple platforms, online, on air. They're losing a lot of people to television. They're losing people to digital operations that have multiple platforms. So I'm wondering if this is maybe the gray lady, as the New York Times is known, is sort of losing its luster as the paper of record.
At least the playing field seems to be, you know, even five years ago, somebody wouldn't have done that. You know, it would have been characterized as they're on the decline. Now, with the Nate Silvers of the world and the David Pogues of the world, now you're starting to see stars make these migrations. And now all of a sudden people are saying, wow, maybe I can do that. And so there's going to be more of this as there is a leveling. And the New York Times is still the New York Times and probably will continue to be.
What's interesting, though, in how we're seeing the talent leave and disperse in a way is here Brian Stelter, who was a blogger and then a newspaper reporter, going into television. Jeff Zeleny, also newspaper reporter, going to ABC News. We're seeing people disperse over different platforms as well.
And I think the reason for that is because they've been trained to work in those different multiple platforms, whereas in the past you were trained to work mainly in either television or newspapers. Now, and we do this with our students here, we train them to work across platforms. So moving from broadcast to newspaper and back again is not going to be an issue in the future.
Okay. Well, like always, we are out of time before we're out of things to talk about. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen and watch today. There is more background on all the topics we talked about on our links blog under the talk show tab at kbia.org. And you can replay the show there, leave comments for us, or send them via email at views@kbia.org. We appreciate you being here. I'd like to thank RJI's Travis McMillan for directing our show and KBIA's Pat Akers for handling the audio today. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week. We'll be back with another edition of Views of the News.